Today is, well, the year, I tell you, you grow older, time flies. December 9th, 2019, I welcome those in front of me and all those listening across the wide expanse of the Jewish universe. I just want to add to yesterday's shiur. Yesterday's shiur was Baruch Hashem, an introduction to the next shiva of Reb Menashe Klein. So he went through Kiddush, Havdalah, wine, beer, schnapps, etc., bread, and after class, Vic came over to me shaking, and he said, "The Rebbe, what does this mean, that Friday night I should not use grape juice?" So it dawned upon me, I told him, you know, I said to Vic, no, go, do what you're doing. But Vic, I want to add one thing, and I want to see if Jack remembers this. You see, what we did yesterday was a shiur in theory. You're coming over to me and asking me halacha lemaisa. Halacha lemaisa, I have to tell you, it's very simple. The answer I gave you is in the posik in the world. Anyone knows how to learn who wouldn't agree with me. Why? You davened already Friday night. So you're asking me kiddush, it's the rabbanon for you. The kosher bracha. If you're using grape juice, it means you like the grape juice better than wine, which means for you the onig Shabbos is grape juice. You follow? So in that case, I have to paskin for you. Continue to use grape juice. Now watch. The Rav, this goes back many years.
Right. You said that about the
abacosos. Yeah, the abacosos are makpid on grape juice, because I have seen very important people get drunk during a seder. And it's very frightening. Some makpid, not that my own grandchildren listen to me. They're wise guys. But I don't remember the last time I drank regular wine on Pesach. All right. I want to tell you a little story. The Rebbe was giving a shiur in Masechet Shabbat. It's in the 60s. Jack remembers already what happened.
Henry, right.
So Jack, the Rebbe's giving a shiur. And he's dealing with Amir Lakum. And he shows that really Amir Lakum is totally us. People who do this and do that, and they go into an elevator and they tell the guy what floor. It's Amir Lakum. But he says, but there's one sheet, I think it was a Sefer Truma, that Litva Mitzvah, it's Mutter. Even it could even be a Malacha D'Oraita of the Litva Mitzvah, it's Mutter Amir Lakum. But that's a sheet of Dechuya. So this kid is from Boston, from a very prominent family. He lives in Katamon today. And he goes back home, and he tells his mother that when she comes to the west side for Shabbos and she's staying with someone in Chveis on the 10th floor, you can't use the elevator. What do you mean I can't use the elevator? I asked the Rav, and the Rav told me I can use it. So the kid asked the Rav, "Rebbe, in class you said, and my mother, and it was a well-known family, very close to the Rav." So the Rav said to him, "You don't understand. In class, we're talking theory. Your mother asked me a shayla lahalacha. Lahalacha, she's going into the elevator. Says Amir Lakum, it's not more than an isa de rabbanan. You understand? What can Amir Lakum mean? He's doing the malacha, not you. And it's there's a din of Shabbos, keep it vioneg, and everything you do is a mitzvah. Whether you're going upstairs to eat, you're going upstairs to sleep, you're going upstairs to be mavis sedra. No, whatever you do, so certainly we can be samach on the sheet of the chuya, which is not widely accepted. But here we were talking of the rabbanan and Shabbos and kibud v'onig and all that's involved, and health as well. How are you going to walk up 10 flights? All right, a kid of 19 can walk up 10 flights, but a woman of chveis 49, 59, 10 flights. So you see, there's a difference between the theory and the psak. And the reason I said Jack will remember is he knows the person involved, and he asked him, and he correct. Remember, he made some corrections, but he made some corrections. But the story I'm telling you is essentially correct. Okay, then there's one more. I just want to. This is from Rabbi Yonason Hertz. When I spoke about the shul in Hillcrest going Orthodox, the members. So first of all, I gave you the wrong name. I called it Hillcrest Jewish Center. It's called Utopia Parkway Jewish Center or Utopia Jewish Center. Anyone from Hillcrest knows there's a Hillcrest Jewish Center a little further over. That is a large bastion, a conservative temple. That was Rabbi Mupshewitz was rabbi there. A number of blocks over is Utopia on Utopia Parkway. So I gave you the wrong name. I just want to correct myself. He, Rabbi Yonatan Hertz, a student, and he's married to my student, Mechola. I've been their rabbi since 2002. However, due to the demographics of the Hillcrest community, our shul was closed this past summer as we had difficulty in maintaining a minyan. The building was bought by a Bukharan boys' high school, and they are using it as a yeshiva. So that I knew that the Bukharans took over. I don't know if they still have a minyan there at all, an Ashkenaz minyan. It may all be Bukharan. Also, I want to I don't know if they call this a correct, but if you recall our lectures a while back, so we kept on referring to Ramaz's son, the rabbi in Cleveland, who was killed in a car crash, 1917, Samuel Margolis is his name. So evidently I must have said in class Shmuel Margolis. My dear Talmud Baruch Amsel, researching the coming up with the grave, his name in Hebrew was Shlomo Zalman. Samuel in English, Shlomo Zalman in Hebrew, and there's a picture of the tombstone here, so we can't make a mistake. Okay, let's roll. It's a very fascinating class, what we're getting into. But just to briefly summarize, do you listen to my share, do you know what it was? Have you listened the last weeks, year, 10 years, 20, 30, 40? Well, you live once. What do you work during the week? God, you live once. The idea is you take off 7 years and you open up yutorah.org and boy, will you be, and your wife too, there's so much there. Alright, when I learned in Lakewood, they said, how do you dare go to college? So I said, who's going to support me? They said, you have to have bitachon, there'll be a check in the mailbox every week. I didn't believe them, but maybe you should, so you'll follow through and to do. Anyway, to give you just a drop of background, the Elder Rabbanim ruled America, Agudas Rabbanim, 1902-1. But a new type of rabbi was developing. Time is marching on. Time does not stand still. There's now a second, third generation East Europeans in America. And by the mid-30s, there was a need for a new rabbinical organization. There was now a modern rabbi. That's the term I use, a westernized rabbi. Rabbi Goldstein, Rabbi Young, Rabbi Drachman, Rabbi Lukstein, although he's not that big yet, he's a little younger. And in 1935, the Rabbinical Council of America is organized. It's a conglomeration of YU Rabbinic alumni and the OU Rabbinic body that was starting to give hashgacha for the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations. Now, the RCA gets off the floor, and they have problems, who's a member, who has smicha. These are problems that exist until today. Ultimately, they reach the conclusion any smicha from a bona fide rabbinic institution is accepted. A private smicha will not be accepted, but if you have three private smichas, the committee will consider you. And I believe more or less that's the way the RCA functions until today. The biggest problem the RCA had at the start, mixed pews. What do you do about the rabbis' mixed pews? And this issue haunted them. Nowadays, it's not a problem. Everyone knows this is due to Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav single-handedly stood that you cannot have mixed pews. And ultimately, that influenced the entire new generation so that there isn't an Orthodox shul today that still has mixed pews. There may be one or two exceptions, but few and far between. The traditional synagogue of Chicago is gone. Everyone knows you have to have a mechitza. Today we have different problems. What do you do with a shul, for instance, where the women dance with the Sifrei Torah on Simchas Torah? What do we do with a shul where the women make announcements? What do we do with a shul? I was in one shul, I couldn't believe my years. an old lady in her 90s gets up to announce the molad. That's at the show, the women. God, we finally show them sick, sick, and sicker. I can tell you more about that shoe, but let it be. You get the idea. So these are the problems we have today, not the machitza. Now, ultimately, I ended off last week's class that the decision, more or less, that was made. And again, these decisions are life decisions. They're always going to be exceptions to the rule. But the decision was made that if you have mixed pews, it has to be with the permission of your Rosh Yeshiva. And, you know, they'll tell you, go in 2 years, 3 years, see if you can change it. The prime example of that is, and this is where we ended the class, Rabbi Steve Riskin. Rabbi Steve Riskin was a fabulous example, and hear the tape of last week's class. I lived it. I heard it. I gave you my theory on it. I welcome the Weinsteins, and I'm waiting to see a name change, and I'm waiting to see a Tudat Seihut, and I'm waiting to hear that you have the ability to vote in the next upcoming election. V'day l'chakima. And I'm also waiting to understand why you missed yesterday's class. That was really, Baruch Hashem, something. And I'm looking for Effie with candlelight. He wasn't here yesterday, and I couldn't leave my office today. We were busy working there since 6 o'clock in the morning. Coming back here. So now I want to go further. If you think the mixed pews were so simple, now I'll show you how the RCA was embarrassed in the 50s. And these are the stories that you hear about. I lived it. I remember like yesterday. There were, in every community, you had a Baal Tshuva who really took Yiddishkeit seriously. So in New Orleans, there was this Orthodox shul, and the Balabatim voted to make it conservative. So they went to court to fight the Balabatim. And how do you fight it in a secular court? It's very simple, that it's a public trust. Money was given for 100 years to an Orthodox institution. The Constitution reads Orthodox. And now you're going to make it conservative? It's robbing the money that was given over the past 100 years. You're misplacing the trust that was put in this synagogue. Fine. So the conservatives got a lawyer. And he subpoenaed records from RCA. How many members have mixed pews? How can you tell us that having mixed pews is no longer Orthodox if you have this shoe and that shoe and a third shoe and a fourth shoe and they all have mixed pews? So I have to tell you, it's embarrassing. Of course, what the RCA said was that these are exceptions because the Rosh Yeshiva sent the rabbis in. They are only allowed to be there with the Rosh Yeshiva's permission. No, what do you do, Dov, if you're sent in for 2 years, and at the end of 2 years, it's mixed pews, but your salary already has hit at that time $25,000 a year, which is heavy bananas in the 50s. And, you know, you love the shul, they love you. All right, they're mixed pews. But what can we do? You look the other way, you're dabbing with a talus over your head. The classic example, and everyone looks into it, did it really happen? Didn't it happen? It's a very prominent family from Philadelphia. But biggest conservative temple in the United States, then it overtook Brooklyn Jewish Center, Rabbi Leventhal, Crown Heights. So it was in at the tip of Philadelphia. What was it called?
Winwood?
No. But what was the shul called? Har Zion. And what was that area called? Winfield. So it was at the tip of Philadelphia, Winfield. So, that was some shul. So there were a lot of Shomer Shabbos who davened there. At that time, there was one shtibble. Later, there's the Young Israel, and then there's Lower Merion Synagogue, so they pull away. But at that point, there were Shomer Shabbos Jews. Among them were children of a Chassidic Rebbe from Philadelphia, and his grandson is being bar mitzvah. And all I can tell you is when I came to Lower Merion in 61 as the second rabbi there, Jerry Herzog, the Chonel of Racha, preceded me. I was the second rabbi. And everyone was talking about the time of the bar mitzvah. His grandfather, the Talmud Rebbe, came and they built a mechitza around the Rebbe. You follow? In other words, we have a mechitza between men and women. But mark here, they built the mechitza around the Rebbe. So, all right, it's embarrassing. It went to court. Ultimately, there was the New Orleans case, there was the Mount Clemens case. You can win in court, but on the ground you can't win. Because what happened in all these instances, including what we spoke about, Cleveland, the Jewish center, the Baal HaBatim said, all right, you keep the Orthodox shul, and they put up another $100,000, went down the block and bought land and built a nice conservative temple. But it's interesting that it boomeranged in some of the testimony. Ultimately, a judge who understands there's a lachatchila and a bidiyavad, that lachatchila, a shul has to have a mechitza, you can't take it down, even a non-Jewish judge can understand this. Alright, there could be exceptions, but it doesn't change the basic concept, the basic rule. Alright. Now, how did the RCA get members? Well, automatically, if you look at the statistics, yeshiva was turning out 30, 40 rabbis a year. Chicago was turning out 10, 15 rabbis a year. Rabbis were coming in from Europe. Rabbis were coming in from Israel. And the RCA was attracting. They never had to ask anyone to become a member. They set up the rules. You couldn't become a member when you got smicha. I had to wait 1 year. I remember this distinctly. I imagine it's the same thing today. 1 year in the rabbinate, then you could apply for membership. You had to have people who vouched that you were honest and upright and ethical. But there were a few exceptions to the rule. Who do you think was the first person that the RCA invited to become an honorary member, never had to pay dues? No? Moriah Rebbe, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. He was the first person invited. He was in the Agudas HaRabbanim. But by the early 50s, I think you understand, the Rav had Americanized. I can't say totally Americanized, but I think he was 20% Agudas HaRabbanim and 80% RCA by the time I knew the Rav. What do you say, Yitzchak? What do you say? 80-20. I can't say he was totally, but he had Americanized. I write about it in my second volume on the Rav, where he talks about Yeshiva University, describes his own identity with the yeshiva. So, you know, the Rav had a good sense of humor. He didn't take himself too seriously, at least in public. He knew how to punch himself occasionally. So one of his greatest comments was, I translated it from the Yiddish into the English. One of his greatest comments was, I lose my head all over. I was from the Agudas HaRabbanim, I was an old type Rav, so I lost my head in the Schlachthaus, in the slaughterhouse. And then I always spoke, I was a modern rabbi, yet I lost my head at a wedding speaking, at a eulogizing someone. He said, I could lose my head either way. He was the first one invited. In addition, they invited the chief rabbi of the Syrian community. At that time it was Rav Yitzchak Alkalai, and later the two chief rabbis of the British Empire, Rav Yisrael Brody, who was Ashkenaz, and Rav Shlomo HaChacham, Shlomo Gaon, who was the head of the Sfada community. However, the most interesting story with inviting people to join was the story with a name that I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Rabbi Charles Eliezer Hillel Kalva. If anyone is here from Denver, Colorado, you can correct my pronunciation of his last name. Now, this Rabbi Kalva, very fascinating life story. He lived a very long life, Kanayin Har, although at my age it's not so long anymore. He was born in 1879. He died in 1971, so he was either 91 or 92, born in Vilna, Lithuania. And he is the man that built Denver, Colorado. Denver, Colorado always had a Jewish community because of tuberculosis. They would come out there, they had a sanitarium. You know, I'm talking about the air, you're up very high, the air is very good. I was at a very fascinating community, Denver. To go into the mountains, and it's a minute out of Denver, a few minutes out of Denver, you're in unbelievable mountains and clear air. Wow. And it always had a Jewish community. And he came there, he came to America as a young man, and he was an early graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And he was a frum guy, but he built this big shul, caught up with the conservative dream that all we have to do is make one or two compromises and we'll be able to perpetuate Yiddishkeit in America. And he went out and built the shul, had mixed seating, but there always was in the base medrash an Orthodox shul. He doesn't want to force elderly people, old timers, you to pay a shayitin. They had their shul, they had their base medrash, and then for the Americans, the second, the third generation, you had a beautiful, beautiful temple. And he was rabbi, caught up with the dream, but he basically was from it. This is like a story out of Atlanta, Georgia. Remember what we spoke about last year with Harry Epstein, with the Lavush Mordechai's nephew. By the early 50s, I would imagine what reached the end of his conservative thinking was the heter to drive the shul on Shabbos. Remember, that shiva was written in, it appeared in public, I believe, in 53. It was adopted by three very, remember what I told you, the conservative movement, their rabbinic, their Committee on Jewish Law had 23 members. In order for something to be recognized as a valid opinion, three rabbis had to agree with it. And of course, here you had three very prominent rabbis, Agus, Friedman, Adler, all of Orthodox origins, and they're writing the responsum permitting driving. And this evidently was the Makaba Patish that pushed Rabbi Kalva over the cliff. And at that point, he made up his mind that conservatives are going to become reform. And what he did with his shul, and this is fascinating, he was so beloved, he had been there so many years, he was there like 60 plus years, they loved him, they voted to leave the United Synagogue and to join the OU. And for the OU, this was a big coup, a major synagogue. There was a mixed seating there. Yeah, but there also was an Orthodox shul. You follow? You had both under one roof. The davening was the same in both areas, the big temple and the Beis Medrash. But one had mixed seating, and one, of course, had a mechitza. That was one change they made. Another change, and I'd like to know if someone from Denver can tell me what's going on today. Another change they made, they put into the Constitution that the rabbi of the synagogue must always be a graduate of the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Very fascinating. And he, very big Zionist, organized Mizrahi. He's buried in Sanhedrin with the great leaders of Mizrahi. Did wonders. And they requested, can the RCA take him as a member? And they investigated, they checked, at this point, Rabbi Kalman was there, we'll come to Rabbi Kalman later, and they checked it out, and the man was a Shomer Mitzvah, 1,000%. True, he was rabbi of a conservative temple, but simultaneously, he was rabbi of a very fine Orthodox based Midrash Minyan. And he was like the Rav. They invited him, but covered, to join the RCA. I'm very curious if anyone knows his children, his grandchildren, what remained of him. I can tell you about Denver that I was the guest of the community. It's a very split community. This is after his time. But as you know, the swing to the right So the swing to the right involves we are right and everyone else is wrong. And you see that in Art Scroll, though. I don't have to repeat my talk of last Thursday night, but you see that all the time, that they deny there ever was Bernard Revel, they deny there ever was Yeshiva Sifts Chalchanan. It's not like Rakefetz Hashkafa. We have our viewpoint, but there are other wonderful viewpoints out there. In Denver, the community is very, very split. One side of the town is right-wing, a branch of Lakewood, a famous yeshiva. On the other side of the town is the modern Orthodox, which, YU in the full sense of the word, the Beis Medrash, this particular shul, gave birth to a number of other Orthodox shuls who left the Beis Medrash, moved away, and organized a few blocks away, a real Orthodox shul without a conservative temple, but it's a very, very split community. I can tell you how split it is, B'didi HaVeYuvda, 1980, the Israeli government sent me to speak in America. This was a way to get onto college campuses and combat Arab propaganda. So they would use people who have scholastic degrees, academic degrees, publications, etc. So I was the guest of the community through the Jewish Agency. And I spoke all over. And one of the places I spoke was the Reform Temple. And I said, I won't speak as part of the service, but it was the men's club. You know what I spoke about in that men's club? People remember it until today. People meet me and kiss me. I spoke on Tarat Mishpacha at the men's club of the Reform Temple. And a lot of frumpi, and they were, so it really made a big impression. It made such a big impression that some of the wealthy people in the Kehillah turned to the Rosh Yeshiva of the yeshiva there, who I'd learned with in Lakewood, Reb Shaul Kagan, and I think the other one was Rabbi Wasserman, if I remember correctly. I certainly knew Rabbi Kagan from Lakewood. And why didn't you invite Rabbi Rakefet to speak? This is that. And they said, look, I don't repeat their exact words. It's not nice for me. But we know he's this, he's that. But we can't allow our students to see such an individual with a kippah srugah. Ad kedei kach was the split. We can't allow them to see a Talmud Chacham with a kippah srugah. You understand? That's that Denver community. But Rabbi Kalva, and who were the Rabbanim there? Nu Yitzchak, when we graduated yeshiva, who was one of our most famous colleagues, went into the rabbinate, spoke at our Chag HaSmicha, Harav Eliyahu Steinhorn. Do you remember him? Jack Steinhorn. Jack, better Jack. No, where was he rabbi? Denver, Colorado, in this very shul. Later, Stanley Wagner came in. Why you graduate, they're no longer alive. I could entertain you with stories about Jack Steinhorn was the most fascinating individual you could ever meet. Here he was in a semi-conservative temple. He winds up in South Africa. He winds up teaching in Germany in theological seminaries, non-Jewish, and in South Africa, the rabbinate is very strong. They say, you're no longer Orthodox. You teach here, you teach there. Ultimately, he comes to Israel, and this is already with his third wife, and I meet him at the Kotel, my classmate, not just my classmate, we grew up together in the Bronx. We know each other 80 years, at that time 70 years. And I meet him at the Kotel, and he comes over to me. Arnie, you don't recognize me? A Jew with a long beard, and payas, with a shtreimel, with a bekesha. And I say, who the heck are you? He says, I'm Jack Steinhorn. I fainted on the spot at the Kotel. I found out later, in his old age, he discovered he has an anicle of the Abdurav, and he went back to his roots. So, but that was Jack. But when we graduated, he was here in this shul. All right, this reflects. But now we come. Who were the people? Who were the rabbanim? Who were putting RCA on the map? So first of all, I want to mention one individual who played a very big role at the time. A name that today, Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg. Anyone recognize the name? He was crucial in the formation of the RCA. Why? He got involved with Kashrut. By the way, Charlie, do you know where his ordination is from? Was he a graduate of Hildesheimer? Because he's not a one. I checked Reitz. His name is not there. But his English was perfect. Am I right or wrong? His English was not accented. I remember him. He evidently had a Europäische ordination. It could be Hungarian or German. Could be British. I couldn't find printed biographical material. I knew his son here, but, you know, if I could go back in my time machine, I would ask his son, but somehow my time machine doesn't work that well lately. Anyway. Jews College gave Smith, for sure. And it could be. He was very, but I'll tell you why he was such a key figure. He got involved in Kashrut. If you read any of the memoir literature, you'll see OU, Kashrut, Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg. He was so ethical, moral, his appearance, his insight, he put the OU on the map. And here, I can read to you, this is from an article that appeared in Ami magazine in November 14th, 2018. So they write about him. He saw the potential of the OU, not just sunshine crackers, but we got to reach out to the biggest manufacturers. So he approaches Robert E. Reitz Sr., the head of the Rich Products Corporation based in Buffalo, New York, which specialized in soy-based foods like non-dairy whipped cream. Rich, who wasn't Jewish, was a wealthy businessman who owned the Buffalo Bills football team. The local stadium had even been named after him. Rabbi Rosenberg explained to him that if his company agreed to be supervised, it would surely bring great financial benefit. Mr. Rich agreed. The O sent down a team of mashgichim. His art department even designed labels bearing a very large OU, in contrast to some companies for whose product you need a magnifying glass to see it. Sure enough, for every quarter thereafter, the company sales doubled. Next, Rabbi Rosenberg explained that they add the word parav. What's that? Queried Mr. Rich. The rabbi explained that this would assure skeptical housewives that these products were really non-dairy. Mr. Rich went along with the plan and saw his sales boom, and the Buffalo Bills had a winning streak to boot. But you see, he went at Rich. You're talking here. Now, you should know, I saw the OU, I saw the inner workings. The Goyim have the greatest respect. Here you're dealing with a WASP, you're dealing with Mr. America, you're dealing with a football owner. Today all the Jews on football teams, basketball, but we're talking 40, 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago. And you get a company like that, and take a look, they have a branch that manufactures in Israel today. We have products in Israel that you can't get in New York. Probably pomegranate and flatbush imports, that I would imagine. The parva cakes, and it's very popular today because it's healthier. There are people who can't drink milk at all, and people who claim that this is healthier. They have a market. They succeed. This was Alexander Rosenberg. He was an astute businessman, and he understood the food business. And here's very interesting. The head of Duncan Hines once said that everything he knew about marketing, he learned from Rabbi Rosenberg. And here the article explains, you know, it's very important in marketing. You want to be a businessman, right? You go, listen, I have to sell my classes. So you notice the signs I put up, catchy titles. I learned that in the rabbinate. If you have an erudite title, an astute title, people will go to sleep, won't even come. But if you have some crazy title and give the same talk, but one word of a joke, you'll attract. He understood sales. He says to Duncan Hines, you must get an OU. So he looks at him. You're a salesman. What does it mean? You'll have an OU in the big cities where there are a lot of Jews. New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit. What happens when you have a lot of sales? The stores that sell, the big supermarkets, give you the top space on the shelf. Now, what's the top space on the shelf? Just think for a minute. Not high and not low. Eye level. Well, if you have a product, let's say you have an esoteric product that sells $100,000 worth in a year. You have a product that sells $1 million, the more you sell, the more the store makes, they're going to give you top space. And sure enough, he went OU, the sales increased, and Duncan Hines, take a look at Hines baked beans, what became? Take a look, major company after major company. Hines was in the 30s. Alexander Rosenberg. And Hines, you know, was a big, big problem for the OU. Because remember, we spoke about it a few years ago. The rumor went out that there was one can of beans with pork and beans. And they were spreading it and spreading it. Something got mixed up with the labeling. Whether there was or wasn't, I don't know. But they take every precaution. I saw the people from Heinz come to a dinner at the OU in New York celebrating 50 years that they were under Hashgacha. 75 years, I was there. And I saw them walk in. They fell korim before Rabbi Ganak. You couldn't believe the Derech Eretz. Halavai, your Balabatim, when you were Rav in Pennsylvania, had that Derech Eretz for you. You follow? So that is also very fascinating. This was Alexander Rosenberg. He was rabbi, if I'm not mistaken, in Mount Vernon. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Charlie. He was in Mount Vernon, but he, more than anyone, built the OU. He was above. There was never a bad word about him. People had such derech eretz for him. But when all is said and done, we come to the high point of today.
One second, you mentioned him, but that's all history of OU. How is he involved?
No, he's the one who said we have to have a rabbinic organization. We can't go on by having hop-lop a few rabbis working for the OU, and he helped bring together the OU rabbis, the YU rabbis, the four, what later becomes YU, I should say, Yeshivas V'Shulchanim graduates, there's no YU yet, 1935, forming the RCA. He was one of the dominant personalities, and he was widely, widely respected. Now, the man who built the RCA, it's one man, and I want to talk about him. Israel Klavan. Last name spelled K-L-A-V-A-N. Over the decades, I taught members of his own family. I remember we had a nephew right here in the Kollel. Israel Klavan, I trust you've heard the name. One of a kind. What was happening in RCA, as the institution starts to grow, you need someone to run the office. You can't let a rabbinic organization, 300 members, 400 members, 500 members, you need someone to run it. So at first, what today is YU provided some secretarial help, but that was Kaliach Yad. Then they had rabbis who volunteered. Morris Max was involved, then he goes to Jamaica, the first rabbi in Queens, very prominent rabbi. You know the family. He has one daughter married to Rabbi Professor Blitzstein. Jerry Blitzstein is his son-in-law. Isaacs was his son-in-law. There's a Shulamit Isaacs, that's the daughter of Rabbi Morris Max, lives in Shimoni, Rehob Shimoni, across the street from you. Very prominent rabbi. But he was Kaliach Yad. By the mid-50s already, early 50s, they recognize they have to have someone full-time. And here you have Izzy Klavan. It was like Minishamayim. Who was he? First of all, his years, he died relatively young. A lot of Akmas Nefesh for me personally. He was took a year off sabbatical to come to Israel, lived next door to us, the next building. And in the middle of the year, he had to run back to America. There were health problems. 1915 to 1980. Born in Lithuania, His father was a Yudapeyish Rav, Rabbi Yoshua Klavan. You knew him.
Very close.
You know what I'm talking about, the Talmud Chachim par excellence. He was rabbi first in Burlington, Vermont, and then in Washington. And Izzy Klavan grew up in a rabbinic home, and he was a Rav, and, you know, the usual, he was a graduate of Yeshiva University in 1940, so he's yet a Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rabbi Revel. It's before the Rav, before Rav Shmuel Belkin. And he was rabbi, ultimately, in Mount Vernon. And first they hired him part-time, and then he became full-time, and they told him, you have to leave the rabbinate, we need you full-time. And he goes on to become, first he's called the executive secretary, then he's called the first vice president. Why is his position so important? So let me explain on the ground, and then the divine guidance here. On the ground, his position is very important for one simple reason. RCA elects a new president every 2 years. Some of the presidents are from out of town. We've already had presidents, I believe, as far away as Los Angeles today. No, they're here, they're not here. What do you mean 2 years? 2 years, it takes 1 year to learn the tricks of the trade, then the next year you're already thinking what you'll do after your term ends. Rabbi Klavan represents continuity. He was always there, and he was very smart. When a guy is president of RCA, listen very carefully. You know I lost my ego in my first rabbinate. It could have killed me altogether, but all right, I lost my ego, maybe other aspects of life too. My values shifted entirely. Please close the door here. Thank you. My values shifted entirely for what I wanted to accomplish in life. But say them. Rabbis have the egos. And the best story I can tell you, this I heard with my own ears from the person involved, I'll mention his name, Rabbi Zeb Siegel, Zichrono Levracha of Newark, New Jersey. Yitzchak, you remember him? Rabbi Siegel, like a linebacker, 6'4", heavy. Israeli, Bamakar, graduate of Chicago. So he told me the story. He goes to Israel, it's the 50s. Rabbi, president of RCA, or vice president, big shot in RCA, and he's wearing a Eli, listen to every syllable, wearing big day kahuna with a proper rabbinic hat. You won't make any mistake, this guy's an American rabbi. No, at that time, all the cab drivers were World War II survivors. Ashkenaz, not like afterwards, you have the whole period where the cab drivers today are all Sfardim. In New York, it's all Russians, but then it was... So he gets into the head, and they start talking Yiddish, of course, and the Keranur, and he's, no, was tut mean, was tut dir, what are you doing in Marty? He's, rabbi, ego, this, wow. So this cab driver decided to teach him a lesson. He says, do I have to speak English, or can I do it? Oh, God, I gotta do it in English, it's impossible. He says, big rabbi, Newark. Yeah, I hope you heard from Newark. I heard of Newark. Sag mir, du hast gekrügen ein Einladens und Brisker Rav's Tochter's Chassana. You got a wedding invitation to the Brisker Rav's wedding. She was marrying Yankel Schiff. And he said, you know, he has to admit, no. As a big rabbi like you, driving with one hand, the other hand, into the glove compartment. Pulls out an invitation and passes it back to him. So Zeb Siegel's now in a state of shock. This cab driver, he says to him, "Wie kommt das? How do you have an invitation to the Brisker Rav's daughter's wedding?" And the cab driver says, "You dummy. I'm a Soloveitchik. In our world, either you learn and become an Avim Gadol, or you don't learn and you become a cab driver." He was a Soloveitchik, or related to the Soloveitchik. So you see, in order to be executive vice president, you gotta stay in the background. You gotta let the rabbi hit it. Yitz, you're reading me? The president of RCA. Yeah. Don't You're running the show. You're running the organization. He's here. He's gone. But you know, he knew exactly how to deal, to caress their egos. All right? Am I saying it right? This was the greatness of Izzy Clayton. The man had such seichel, he was perfect for the job. It's one part of it. You knew him? You knew Izzy? Describing him well? Okay. Professor Tarragon agrees with the Rebbe's description on that level. We'll take it further now. But there was a divine guidance here. Moriu Rebbe, he built YU, he built RCA. Whatever we talk about, Western Orthodoxy, modern Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy, everything goes back to the Rav. I don't know what would have been. Tova Lichtenstein wrote a beautiful article in Tradition where she claimed that not for our father, basically, there'd be only right-wing Torah in America and everyone else would be conservative. I don't know if it's true or not. But there's no question the Rav was the dominant personality in RCA. No? What do you know about the Rav? The lonely man of faith. Have you seen that documentary that a friend of mine named Aaron Rakefet brought into the world? The Lonely Man of Faith. I don't agree with it. I thought they overdid it, but my job was to dream that dream of the documentary, to fight against all odds to get $1 million. That was my wife's achievement. Her grandfather, I told you, used to blow shofar father's shul. So now my grandson blows that shofar in Haifa, blowing his great-great-great-grandfather's shofar, Kanayin Hara. But once I got the producer, I stepped aside, and particularly Ariane Abe Levovitz knew the Rav very well. So you see the way they portray the Rav. Remember they interviewed Professor Vogelanter? The loneliest man I ever saw. You remember that? You know how many people came to me. Was the Rav really that lonely? All right, but the Rav writes Lonely Man of Faith. The truth was, intellectually, he was lonely. In other words, when you're a great Talmud Chacham and you have great vision and you got to deal with the Hamona Am, stupidity on top of stupidity, no knowledge, no foresight, no vision, it's difficult. But the Rav found his kindred soul, Izzy Clayton. And it's not just they got along. They understood each other. Ad hasof. They confided in each other. Is there anyone in this room whose life is perfect? Raise your hand. Jack, I can tell you that you cannot raise your hand. I can tell Raquette that he cannot raise his hand. Morty, you can't raise your hand. Yitzchak, you can't raise your hand. I know these people intimately. No one's life is perfect. Vic, you can't raise your hand. With the grape juice and all. And Yomo, you can't raise the hand. No question. He's going to give me his talking to. Yomo, don't argue. When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. Relax. God, I got a Baruch Hashem. The Rav used to unburden himself to Izzy Clayton. Izzy Clayton used to unburden himself to the Rav. Now, how do I know all this? First of all, I knew the Rav intimately, which is good and bad, because I suffer. I read these books that are coming out now about the Rav. There's no resemblance between the real Rav and these people who are creating him from his writings or from some of his students. All right. But that was the Rav. I knew Izzy Clayton intimately. More than that. Does a book lie? I quote to you from the Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 2. I won't tell you who the author is. Page 67. Here. I had a tape. I copied word by word. Related by the Rav in response to Rabbi Israel Klavan's introduction at the RCA Annual Convention, June 20th, 1979. This is Izzy Klavan, RCA, the Rav, all right? In the tailspin of their prime. Izzy Klavan just introduced the Rav, Rabbinical Council Convention. Thank you, Rabbi Klavan, for introductory remarks. I feel about you as you feel about me. I was not the one who exerted the influence. I was not always the mashpia. And you were not always the makabel. I do not know who influenced whom. There is no doubt that there are certain things I have learned from Rabbi Klavan. It is hard for me to portray my emotions. I was trained in my home as a child not to display emotions. If you love somebody, love him. Him or her, with all your heart and soul. But do not tell anybody about it. Do not tell any about it, even not even the person you love. Wow. I have told people many times, I never received a kiss from my father. Never. Even at the time when I departed from Warsaw and left him from Berlin, and no one knew whether I would seek him again or see him again or not, my father did not kiss me. He just shook my hand and said, Lech l'shalom, HaKadosh Baruch Hu zol dir matzliach sein. Wow. No doubt about it, people were standing on the train platform and saw this strange behavior. They thought, this is Frisk, which has no concern from the heart, only the mind. The mind is cold, whereas the heart is warm and overflowing. That is why Reb Moshe could not give a kiss to his son. It is not so. I know my father loved me very much, very much. In actuality, whatever I possess belongs to my father, Shali v'shalachem, Shalohu. I am a friend of Rabbi Klavan, yet I cannot portray my friendship for him. I have a great deal of respect for him, a great deal. As a matter of fact, let me add that the Rambam, on Pirkei Avot, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Vav, explains that friendship is a threefold experience. As a matter of fact, friendship imposes a triple duty on the friends. First of all, a friend must be a Chabal Ezra, a friend for help. When your friend is in trouble, he has the right to knock on the door of the person who has been his friend and asks for help. Then Maimonides speaks of friendship in the sense of Chavel Dava, a friend for conversation. This friendship which one experiences while confiding in another. Friendship is achieved if I have faith in someone and do not hide anything from him. I confide in him or to him, both good news and bad news. It means that man can unburden himself with all his worries, fears, and doubts. He can unburden himself only to a person in whom he has absolute, unlimited faith and confidence. As a matter of fact, I confided in Rabbi Klavan quite often. We used to think not only about the RCA. The RCA took up very little time. Then I would confide in him, and he would reciprocate and confide in me. We would discuss our personal worries. There is no man without such problems. Man is burdened with worries and doubts. Thirdly, my man, this requires a friend should be a chabaladeya, a similar outlook. There should be a united effort to achieve something great. There should be the same ultimate end, purpose and goal, the same vision. Should attract both friends. Their world perspectives should merge into one great perspective. I've had differences with Rabbi Kleiven. At times I had, perhaps I still have. However, basically, we are chaverim l'deya. We march and move toward one destination. Our outlook on Yahadut is the same. And this is the Rav's response to Izzy Klavan's introduction. I need not tell you, it speaks for itself. And this relationship was crucial to the development of the RCA. I need not tell you that in all the years that have subsequently gone by, we've never yet had that exact cooperation, combination, synthesis, call it what you wish, of a person of the rough stature. And I don't want to put down my dear student today, Rabbi Mark Dratch, Executive Vice President of RCA, is a fabulous person. But there's not a focal rabbinic figure in RCA anymore. I've heard some of the gossip beneath the surface. Not so simple. Right wing, centrist, left wing, but no dominant personality. The greatness of the Rav, that when he spoke, when he took a stand, you couldn't oppose him. Machloket could go on. What was the Rav's actual opinion? Synagogue council will come to it. All right, that machlokes was legitimate because the Rav was very nuanced, and you could interpret him either way, and the Rav at times did give both opinions within a certain threshold. But we don't have anyone like that today. I mentioned one name, a great Rosh Yeshiva, right away criticisms. You mention another name, right away criticisms. But this unique relationship between the Rav and Rabbi Kleiven, this built RCA. When the Rav came in, he had a few hundred rabbis at that time. Today, RCA is the biggest rabbinical organization in the world. Already was the biggest rabbinical organization in the Rav's lifetime. And it was that partnership that put it on the map. And you have to salute Rabbi Israel Kleiven, and the man had seichel. When they proposed inviting Rabbi Kalfa to join RCA, he checked it out, absolutely. To take in a man of that prestige, a man who was big enough to announce that he's breaking with the conservative movement, that was able to pull his shul out of synagogue council, out of United Synagogue, and bring it into OU, and get them to put in their constitution charter that every rabbi has to be a Reitz graduate. Let's look at the Beis Medrash that he's rabbi of, not the conservative temple where he also gives a sermon. And this was Izzy Klavan. He became the backbone of the Rabbinical Council of America, plain and simple.
What you're showing us is the army, RCA is bigger than the RA in the...
Yeah, yeah, it's the biggest, it's the biggest rabbinical organization. I don't know, it's certainly the biggest Orthodox, whether it's bigger than RA or the CCAR, I don't know. I don't want to say. Because remember, they may count every Tom, Dick, and Harry claims they're a rabbi.
Tom, Dick, and Jane.
And you have one woman there. This I saw with my own eyes, and I checked it out. She's not even Jewish. Only her father was. And she's a lesbian. And she doesn't believe in God. She's a humanist. And she's listed as a rabbi, a graduate of Hebrew Union, etc. Then you have places in Boston, non-denominational. There was something in Philadelphia like that. I had a student who taught there. Again, a character par excellence. And what kind of rabbi is that? Non-denominational. Wow. Okay. Now, RCA got involved in something else at a very early stage that they were a forerunner. They were a precursor in this. It was a nascent achievement that later characterizes America today. A kid growing up in the United States, 1920s, 1930s, How does he have something about Judaism? Where can he read? Where can he get information? Rabbi Young was the first to start his series of books. By the 1950s, RCA picked up on this concept, and three different levels, they started producing endless published material. I can say actually four different levels. I'll do the first two that you probably don't know about. Number one, they started publishing a quarterly rabbinic journal. What's going on in the RCA? What's happening? Debates going back and forth. Today, this is all done on the internet. It's a different world today. You log in, you have a code, they discuss issues, right? It's beyond me. It's a new world. I admit that I may yet live to see where there'll be no money. I think within 10 years, no one will be carrying money. You just wave your card, it debits the card, vigomanu. It's very fascinating, the world. And I remember I told you, I asked my mother, what was the greatest change you saw in your life? My mother lived almost a century, so she said indoor plumbing. If anyone asks me what's the greatest change I ever saw, it's the computer. Last year, my children took us to Italy, to Venice, and we traveled through Verona and Milan, and my son-in-law never made one wrong turn. A little gizmo guides you. You don't know the language, don't know the land, you were never here before, and they didn't make one wrong turn. So all this goes on today on the internet. They discuss, they chat, the chat room, whatever they call it. Rabbinic Quarterly, very important. You kept up on the news. Every rabbi got it, no matter where you were. You're a member of RCA. You have a right to join, to respond to the next issue. Then there was a second part of RCA that's long been forgotten. Yitzchak, when we got smicha and wanted to print the sermon, where did we go for material? The sermon manual. Every year, Rabbinical Council of America came up with a sermon. Remember it or not? When I went in, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Today, everything is online. You ask a shayla, should I observe Yontif Sheni? You type it into the computer and you get 1,000 pages on the topics. Now, I don't know what the answer ultimate. Then they have asked the rabbi who'll talk and give you an answer. It's unbelievable what goes on today. But remember the sermon when I went in Aliyah? I remember I sold all my sermon. I was at 10-20. A young rabbi, I think I got I said, I wanted to give it him for nothing, but you know, if you give it for nothing, they feel awkward. So I think he gave me $5, and I hope he's still preaching sermons from those many sermon manuals I passed on to him. But some of the sermons, you had Rabbi Hochstein in there. You had Rabbi Shoffman. You had Rabbi Berzon, Dov, Hagadayla Mesheba Aretz. Did your father ever consult the sermon manual? How good was your father in English? How good was your uncle in English?
It was better in Yiddish than in English. But
he spoke English. But to read it? Because I just got a inquiry. Someone asked me whether I read Yiddish. And I answered, I read Yiddish like my grandchildren read English. You understand what I'm saying? Hebrew and English, I'm fluent. But the Yiddish, I speak it. I understand it 100%. But to read it, please, I don't have time. I can read it, but it'll take me 10 times as long with the aleph and the ayin and the two yuds and everything that's in it. You can so. But all right, the sermon manual. But then let me go further. Rabbinic manual, Hadarom. This I believe still goes on until today. A major halachic rabbinic scholarship. Contribution, this was RCA. And then, Al Kulam, tradition. How much do you have today? Flatbush puts out, what's it called? Hakira. And a terrific issue. YU occasionally puts out Torah Mada Journal. And it all goes back to tradition. Normie Lamb, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, first editor. A terrific scholar, you know. You got to realize This man went on to become president of YU. Had he not become president of YU, I think there would have been a lot more scholarship. The same with Rav Shmuel Belkin, the same with Rabbi Revel. They gave up their scholarship for what they did. I can tell you also, Steve Riskin is an example. Steve is a very bright individual. And to build Lincoln Square and to build Efrat, you have to pay a price. A dummy like Rakefet sits behind his desk, does nothing else. It's all right, so he produces a little. Yitzchak, what do you have to say?
This morning I saw on the internet an actor by the name of Chaim Levy.
Yeah.
Is now putting on a show, a play.
Of his life, of Risk.
The life of Rabbi Risker.
Right.
Amazing.
Right, no, the man deserves all the credit. He built that front, all the credit. All right, he's gone a little to left for my likings, but all right, he's entitled to his opinion, we'll put it that way. I wish the Rav were here. You see, if the Rav would be a Rebbe, we'd solve it. The Rav would give even Yitz Rubin would fall into place. You follow me? We wouldn't argue with the Rav, even if left, center, right? Sometimes he'd be amorphous, you follow? Of course, flexible.
But you know, the Rav has what to say even if he's not alive. This business of he's gone, that was a generation ago. That's gone.
That's...
You don't say what did Rashi say in this person, you say what does Rashi say in this
person. Right, I agree.
This is what the book taught us.
But a Talmud, you're absolutely right. But the best part of my book that's been quoted, recorded, it's also in the documentary, is the Rav talking about his classroom. Who's in the classroom? Remember that? Who walks in? The old man, and beautiful. But
right,
between generations. But as you know, you're dealing with a new generation, and as my Talmud says, said to me, "Oh, your Rebbe, he hasn't been active since the 70s." All right, but halavai. Okay, interesting. You mentioned the Rav. I want to go one step further. So you have the quarterly journal, the sermon manual, Hadarom tradition. These were big innovations. But there's something more. And here, you have to give credit to Rabbi David Hollander, who we'll talk about. In his administration, it's the mid-50s, early 50s, he said, we have to do more than just be a rabbinic organization. We have to reach out to the public. And he proposed a Shuvidresha. One of the RCA Rabbanim should give a public Shuvidresha. And of course, all the eyes turned to the Rav. Gave the first Russia in 1954. 400 people turned out. Now, by the standards of the early 50s, that was a tremendous crowd. That Russia became an annual event, second only to the Rav's Yotzeit Russia in memory of his father, Gimel Shvat. The Yotzeit Russia, the Tshuva Russia, this showcased the Torah world for American Jewry. Began with 400, and Arsay was very makpid. They didn't allow it to be given in Yeshiva University. The idea was it should represent RCA, not YU. And it was given in hotels, many different locations over the years, because ultimately the crowd went from hundreds to thousands. Books have been published, I need not tell you. Al HaTshuva, it's probably the most widely disseminated book of anything published in the name of the Rav. The Rav did not publish it, but Pinchas Pelli, on his own, from recordings translated from the Rav's Yiddish into Hebrew. And the Rav was very impressed with Pelli, who had a very gifted pen. It runs in his family. He has daughters, granddaughter, has a daughter, granddaughter. I've seen until today the family produces. And that volume you'll find in every yeshiva. People from Hevron, Panovich, let alone Merkaz HaRav, our world has the yeshiva. People hold it in their talis. Zekel in their Talis case on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. It's overwhelming. I've told you more than once over the generations, there's only one place that Peli changed what the Rav said. And that had to do, you remember, where the Rav was developing the idea that Jews have only loyalty to God and Torah. There's no concept of loyalty to a political state. And Peli translated it on purpose. The Rav was referring to the state of Israel, that our loyalty is to Torah. Whatever loyalty we have to the state is a derivative of our loyalty to Torah, the state representing Eretz Yisrael. And Peli felt that would be too sharp, so he translated it like a secular term, a secular state. Who caught it and issued a proclamation against the Rav? Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. I remember this, I was living here already. He caught it, and he came out with a statement that there has to be loyalty to the state, it's Eretz Yisrael, it's God-given, etc., etc. That was the only controversy that ever came up on Peli's translation. Yes, Yitzchak.
Why is it that the memorial lectures for his father and the children were in Yiddish, and then when it came to the memorial lecture for his wife, it was English?
I'll tell you in a second. The Tshuva Drasha continued from 1954 to 1980. Yitzchak asked a very interesting question. The Rav switched to English in 1960. We've spoken about it many times. It's not the time to go into it. It came up again yesterday after Shir when I dealt with some of the questions I'm getting. But this was the reality. It's a reality. I can't say sad, but it's the reality. I only know Yiddish through miracles. I'm a third generation American, and seventh grade already my Rebbeim spoke only Yiddish. The Shanghai survivors. So I had to learn Yiddish. It was either swim or sink. Yitzchak grew up in a home where his parents' native language was Yiddish, right or wrong. My parents were born in Harlem. Obviously, the native language was English. But I learned Yiddish, and many of the students that I went studied with were survivors or children of parents who ran away to America in the early 30s, mid 30s, etc. So Yiddish was a living language. By 1960 already, it faded. So the Rav was capable of making the switch. However, the Yahrzeit Drasha, the Tshuva Drasha, where he's giving his whole world, his whole youth, his whole life, his whole tradition, the Pleitat Sofreihem, that he could only do in Yiddish. It just, that's it, Nishke Klungin in English. It didn't ring in English. And he retained that until the day he stopped. It was always in Yiddish. You can hear the snippets of it on the internet today out of the 70s, at least from the Tshuva Drasha, it's all in Yiddish. The memorial for his wife, this I lived, Yitzchak, so I don't have to quote anyone. These ears and these eyes. He decided to memorialize his wife in 1968 at the first yard site in Stern College. And his idea was to give a talk that was geared for the mystique of the woman personality. And obviously, if you're going to give a talk in Stern College, circa 1968, you're going to use English. What happened was, people were pressing the Rav that they want to hear the talk, they want to, ultimately, it had to be open to the public. Later it switches to Yeshiva University. But Yitzchak is right. That talk remained totally in English. It never was given in Yiddish. Year after year, there was memorial lecture. Year after year, the Rav dealt with Megillat Esther. It was always given, the Rebbetzin died on Tainat Esther. It was always given Purim Pesach time. He dealt with Mordechai. He dealt time and again, came back to the Megillah. He dealt with Pesach, dealt with the Seder. That always remained in English. It began in English and continued in English. So that's the answer to your question. Today, Yiddish is gone. You take the Aguda convention, whatever books I heard at this convention were in English. I was in Lakewood this summer. Everywhere I went, the only language I heard was English. You can go on and on with examples. I heard Reb Yitzchak Lichtenstein gave a whole shiur at the Aguda convention on Tfilat HaDerech in English. Everything in English. Well, this is a sign of the times, and it's a reality. Is Rakefet happy with it? Absolutely not. I learned in Lakewood, they convinced me when I was 17 years old, 16 years old, that the Torah was given in Yiddish, and I believe them until today. And I can still remember Freddie Zucker, Zichrono Levracha, from Baltimore, saying to me, "Es kennt nicht sein anderisch. Die Eibishtot geredet mit Moshe Rabbeinu, das hat nur gegen sein in Yiddish." Alright, that's it. It's a lot of truth to it. Do I really believe what I just said? Absolutely not. But what can I do? There's the emotion and there's the intellect. You take Rav Avadya Yosef, he knew Kala Torah Kula. He did not know Yiddish. When Rav Shach gave the famous talk in Yad Eliyahu, if I have the right name, and I taped it, I videoed it. Oh, was that a moment in time? And there's the Belzer Rebbe and Rav Avadya sitting next to each other, listening to Rav Shach. And Rav Shach, were you here, Morty? You remember this? And Rav Shach gets, it's the 80s. Rav Shach gets very, Charlie, you remember? Rav Shach gets very emotional. He breaks into Yiddish. And I remember Rav Avadya turns to the Belzer Rebbe, and the Belzer Rebbe is whispering to him in Hebrew what Rav Shach is saying in Yiddish. So you see, here you have Rav Avadya Yosef. I stand in awe of the man. You know, I spoke in learning with him. I knew him. I taught his daughter. He knew Kala Torah Kula Baal Peh, a memory like he had. Anything he looked at, he remembered. And he didn't know Yiddish. No. I think that defeats what they told me in Lakewood, as the Eibishter's Gedet, no Yiddish with Moshe Rabbeinu. Let me go one step further and end off and go further more today. Very interesting what I'm going to talk about in a minute. Let me wet my vocal cords. Where's the water from, Jack? Israel or Italy? I know yesterday's shiur went up already because I got emails about it. So that's played a role, Italy. Now, how do you keep a rabbinic organization going? How do you keep Cheperschaft? You see, the shluchim are all over the world. But once a year, 5,000 shluchim come together. And by the way, I have to correct myself that it's no longer in the Armory in Brooklyn. It used to be the big dinner, but it's not big enough. Today it's in New Jersey. There's a hall there that's big enough to hold the 7,000-8,000 people. That's where it is. It's in New Jersey. I don't know exactly where. Maybe you know. Next time you're in Tina, guess, check it out. So it's very important. It gives you sustenance. It gives you strength. You can discuss problems that bother you. So RCA began with the once a year called the convention. But that wasn't enough. The rabbinate is chai v'kayim. Life is ongoing. Problems exist all over. So they went beyond once a year convention, the midwinter conference. And here too, it's interesting, the convention more or less remained in the New York area, in the Catskills, and the kosher hotels, the Pioneer, the Pine View, although occasionally there were conventions far away from New York. The midwinter conference also, they would shift locations You would go to Detroit, you would go to Chicago, Pittsburgh, to let the big areas there where you had quite a few Orthodox shuls and quite a few RCA Rabbanim to feel part of RCA. You're not being neglected. The whole country is being brought in to the RCA. And these were the conventions. These were the midwinter conferences. I attended many, I remember, as a young rabbi. It was an experience. But ultimately, all these conventions and conferences centered around two personalities, the Rav and Rabbi Klavan. Rabbi Klavan put the program together. Rabbi Klavan ran it. Rabbi Klavan gave kavod to the rabbanim who were elected. Rabbi Klavan worked behind the scenes to keep machlokas to a minimum. After all, if you have two Jews, you're going to have three different opinions. This is part of being a Jew. I'm kishay orev. Rabbi Klavan was a kunstmacher. The man's human relations were fabulous. But the other personality, why did people come? The Rav. And here you saw a side of the Rav that you didn't see in the classroom. Here, the Midwinter Conference, the RCA convention, the high point was the Rav's talk. And here he picked topics totally different than what he did in the classroom. Generally speaking, it was a semi-philosophic topic, semi-halachic. Sometimes he merged the boundaries. Pashanut HaMikra, you all heard some of his most famous talks, no? Dov, Pashit Korach. The machloket, wow, what he did with Korach, what he did with Torah Shebaal Peh, what he did, Talit Shekulot Chelem, the Rav majesty, magic, it's magnificent. Bahalotcha, and that's where at a dinner in honor of Rabbi Klavan, which came after Pashat Bahalotcha, the Rav says, well, wasn't too bad, my drasha. I liked it. And you know, with the footbeats of the people and ready to go in, and Balotcha and the shofin, and the chatzotzrot, what he did, what he recreated. The midwinter conferences, you see, these convention was always around Vamidbar. You wound up with a lot on Vamidbar. The midwinter conferences, Bereshit, Kriyat, Briat Olam, man, woman, what the Rav was capable of doing. Kriyat HaTorah, Birchat HaTorah. We once suffered from the Rav. He spoke at a midwinter conference on Birchat HaTorah, and then he gives us an exam. We were studying Hilchat Pir HaTorah with Or HaChaim. It's 1960, and the Rav gives us an exam. And he asks a question that he never discussed in class. So we asked Aaron Lichtenstein, who was the Rav's assistant. Mali said, Aaron, what's happening here? So Aaron checked with the Rav. He gave that talk at the midwinter conference. You follow? But his mind, he confused it. He classed the great Torah. So Aaron said, all right, let's see what your answers are, and we'll mark it accordingly, you know, give you credit if the answer's halfway decent. If I'm not mistaken, the question that he never discussed in class was if you made the bracha shenat lanu torat emet instead of ashabacha banu, are you yotze? If you made that bracha before and not afterwards. If I'm not mistaken, that was the question that he never discussed in class, but he spoke at RCA. At RCA, I still remember what he said. The shtickle was unbelievable. And then after Kriyat HaTorah, Ashenatan Lanu Torat Emet, Chaylam Tabatachenu. Look what you did with the Torah. You added on one word, Emet. And the Rav said, before you learn Torah, you can't say Emet. God gave you Torah. You don't know what's in it yet. But after you learn, then very proudly, Ashenatan Lanu Torat Emet, then you can add Emet. So let me just reiterate, set the stage for RCA, Modern Orthodoxy, Rabbanim. Yitz is going to be very happy because next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I hope to get to one of your big heroes, Rabbi Emanuel Rachman. Got it? And we'll let Rabbi Rachman speak for himself. But what did we do today? All right, may I say, not a bad shiur. Not a bad, how did the Rav say it? I liked it. Not bad, not bad. And the audience broke into laughter. But all right, not a bad shiur. We covered such nice material. RCA getting off the ground. I would say the question of mixed seating, it really haunted RCA. And you know, when you look back, you can't say get rid of all the shoes that didn't have a mechitza. You had to be very tactful. Rabbi Kalfer, and you see the way Rabbi Klavan throws the invitation out so beautifully. It's mitzeichel. There's no question that the Rav played a dominant role that we know until today, even Shira Chadasha with all the innovations, but there's still the mechitza there. And then I would say Alexander Rosenberg, and as I explained to Yitz, Kashrut, the OU, he represented that element, but he had to combine it with the YU people, and that gives us the backbone of RCA. There's no question more than anyone is E. Klavan. If not for E. Klavan, RCA would have never achieved what it did. And that was the magic symbiotic relationship between Mori Urebi and Rabbi Israel Klavan. It was a beautiful, beautiful relationship. And Ein Hachinami, Manny Holzer once told me how they were sitting together and the Rav was crying in E. Klavan's shoulder with personal problems. And you could see how the Rav had such confidence, love and understanding of Izzy Klavan. And all right, we went on, and the publications, the Yahrzeit Russia, the convention, the Midwinter Conference, RCA is a living organization. But now we have to see what modern orthodoxy is all about. Yitzchak?
Why is it that the OU, with all the money that they get from customers,
The OU funnels it essentially. They give RCA something, don't say nothing. But they funnel it to NCSY and Yachad, and you have to give them all the credit in the world. And they estimate to make a kid from, it costs them $50,000 to send them to Israel, to do this, to do that. Is it worth it? Absolutely. One kid from, down the line, he can have 50 descendants. My mother made one decision back in 42, 43 to send me to yeshiva. Can I tell you how many in our own family, Kanai and Haro, what we have in Israel, myself, my brother, our descendants? It's unbelievable.
My mother, too, in the time when there was depression.
Right.
We didn't even have money to get on the school bus.
Right.
We used to take me in a red wagon.
Right. Yitzchak, I want you to step up here. Dov, I want you to step up here. Good, why you, Miss Machem? You knew the faculty in the 60s, the 70s, Yitzchak knew in the 50s. I want to ask you, who is this? Who is this? I want to ask you, who is this?
The Ben Israel.
Here, Yitzchak Rubin shook this man's hand many times. And I'm asking, who is this? Dov? Gentlemen, you are looking at a young man named Reb David Lifshitz.
No joke.
They don't believe me. Gentlemen, take your seats. You believe me.
We're in Europe, Mr. Fisher?
Thank you. Soon enough, you'll hear everything. Take it. Sit down. I got to look at
this.
Take a seat. You don't wear yarmulkes and pictures. Sit down, please. You can take the picture. Charlie, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. You don't know what a treasure this book is. And I'm going to call the Waxmans and raise the roof with them. First of all, it has to be reorganized. Can't say anything. The story is very simple. We have friends, Chaim and Chaya Waxman. Who are they? She is Reb David Lifshitz's middle daughter. Right. So To make a long story short, they had a painter, and my wife says, it's bothering me, we have to start painting the house again. Painting is a maka shenik tuva b'torah, that's all I can tell you. So we went to see their paint job, and we hired the same guy. I tell you, it was very exhilarating. A guy's a painter from Efrat, here over 30 years. Meir Kahana brought him an aliyah. And he and his son with Kahana shirts, and boy, they were exhilarated. They met Aaron and Malka. We, intimate friends of Meir Kahana, you understand? Not just acquaintances. To him, it's like he met Mashiach, that I know Meir. He was my madrich in Bnei Akiva. I taught his daughters. I taught his son-in-law, taught his daughter-in-law, etc., etc. So while we're at the house, Chaya says, oh, my family just published the book, Lifshitz, Koroteha Shel Mishpacha, Story of a Family. And she shows me the book, and I take a look, I copy the information, it was published by someone living in Rehovot. So I asked Charlie, can you contact this guy? Because if he's going to send it to me, I got to lose a day in the post, it's a nightmare. Turned out the guy lived a few blocks from Charlie in Rehovot. Charlie got the guy said, what the heck does your Rebbe want this book for? It's for the family. Well, my Rebbe, whatever you told him, a historian, you were right. The book is fabulous. It has all the letters that Reb David wrote. It shows you what went on in Europe. It shows you the home he came from. His father learned in the Lushen yet, but everyone, all he spoke in his youth was Hebrew. Big Zionists, Mizrachiites, the children, the family, yeshiva, Grudna, the only ones that were saved, basically, were the three sisters who came in Aliyah. Then you see something else. What became of them here? The Zionist dream, Shomer HaTzair. The Great Rebellion. Charlie, why don't you do research? Go to your, I hope, a friend now, and ask him to give you, is anyone remained from those who came to Israel? I think only one sister out of the three. Check it out, where they are today, five generations later. Fascinating. Reb David, how they saved their lives, how they finally get to Japan with miracles. Gets to America. How he keeps on sending clothes, food, to the family in Palestine. Those that remain behind. Reb David's brother, executed by Stalin in the big purge. They don't find out until years later. And he was a big communist, the brother. Remember the purge? Every second communist was killed. Another brother remains there. Who knows what's left in Russia if they even know they're Jewish anymore. What a volume. The whole modern history of our people is here. But I love the pictures. Here's the wedding picture. Reb David and his wife. It was taken the day after the wedding, and his father-in-law, the Suvalka Rav, insisted they all dressed like they were at the wedding. This is the official portrait. The family. Ugh, what a volume. It's living history before your eyes. And if Yitzhak, if you want the picture to drive someone crazy.
You know, every Thursday.
Yeah.
I would come to his house for an hour. And I would tell him over, because on Thursday he used to give a shiur short, and then he would talk on the parsha. So I would take notes, like I always do.
Right.
So he said to me once, I was very embarrassed and hurt too. He said, what shrimps I'll give to a medal? I said, what are you doing? Why do you get a girl a letter? No. So I said, Rebbe, I'm writing down what you're saying. So he says to me, but I've never been on a bechira. So I said, but I want to learn it. So he says, I want to see what you're writing. Come to my house. So he figured he got me. So I come to his house, and I see he has a New York Times. So I said to him, Rebbe, you have the New York Times. I'm sure you don't have it for decoration.
Right, of course.
And I would, for a year, tell him over the Bach of the Yiddish, every talk he gave.
Wow.
And when he then, at the end of the year, he said, I want you to Xerox all your notes and give it to him.
I have to tell you, I understand Rav David so much better from the book. He could never become an agudist. He and Rav Lesson never, ever went to an aguda convention, basically. They were caught between two worlds. The Frumkeit changed in America, swung to the right. But they were Zionists through and through. Later, Rav Lesson is ruined a little bit by his son-in-law, Rabbi Miller, Avigdor Miller. But Rav David Lifshitz, he worked with Rabbi Teitz, a joint ticket in 1949, Aguda Mizrahi. Dov, do you know this? The book that came out in Rabbi Teitz by Rivka Teitz Blau, married my Chavrita. So, one mistake in the book. She writes that her mother always said to her father, you learn, don't waste time in politics. And then in 49, he tried to get the Mizrahi and he got it through on a joint ticket, and she says, and my mother was right, he wasted his time. I contacted Rivka, there was a joint ticket in 49, and your father, Reb David Lifshitz, played a big role in bringing it about. She checked it out, and she thanked me. So if there's ever a second edition of Love, Live, and Learn Torah on Reb Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, there has to be a footnote. The original edition said, but a guy named Rakefer in Jerusalem corrected me. Gentlemen, the rest of the freebies, wow, Yitzchak, something or not. This is on Kfarim in America. Remember we spoke about Rabbi Simcha Levi? They traced where he's buried and his brother is buried. Both Mishmachim of the Mechita Ivli. This is very interesting. Remember my Shurim on Erev? This is the original booklet that was put out about the Manhattan Erev by Shalom Karmi. Because Charlie Bentheim wanted Rav Kasha's opinion made public. I have the finished version of the book, but here you have the actual manuscript, the corrections, the second version, and the final version. This is my life story. This very interesting, this is again the Rebbe, someone who had a playing the violin at a very early age, and how the Rebbe encourages him to excel in what he's interested in, music. This is the nine Lubavitcher kids who were in Shanghai the day they arrive in Montreal in 1941. Beautiful story. And that becomes the nucleus for the big Lubavitcher yeshiva in Montreal, which thrives until today. This is a writer going to interview the Rebbe, and the Rebbe winds up interviewing him. Very interesting piece of work. Famous people in there. This is beautiful. Full circle. If you recall, a few weeks ago, Mishpacha had an article about Jewish educational media, JEM, that's Chabad, and they included a story about a bacher named Zalman Lipska, who was sent late one night to late filling on a Jew from Long Beach. Well, the article appeared, and he put filling on this Jew, and never knew what happened decades ago. The day after the article appeared, Rabbi Lipska received a call from a reader who introduced herself as the daughter of Louis Shelger, the man to whom the Rebbe had sent the teenage Zalman. For Zalman was just another mission, but the woman at the other end of the line filled in the rest of the story. That encounter with the Bacha and the Tfillin impacted on Louis, bringing new light into his home. Today the caller said she is a mother and a grandmother of a Frim family, all because of that long ago visit. And she reminded Rabbi Lipska of how her father wanted to pay for the service, but the Bacha refused to accept it. Louis offered wine, which the boy turned down because it wasn't kosher. So Louis tried once more giving him a bottle of whiskey. The young man accepted the gift and brought the bottle to the Rebbe's secretary. At the Fabrengin that Shabbos, the Rebbe called young Zalman Lipska up to give him a yashikayach and hand him a lechayim from that bottle. Lechayim, said the Rebbe, perhaps visualizing the long-term results of the brief encounter. And boy, that's powerful. You don't know how you influence a life. Remember I told you I had a kid in Maplewood, and I say, right from Yiddishkeit, the people running away. And a few years ago, I got an email. He listens to every share of mine. He changed back his name to the European name. And today, he's probably firmer than I am. So in Maplewood, I had influence on him. He invited me to Sherer Bracha, separate seating. I told him I can't go with a separate seating, or my wife will give me a gag. Okay. This is beautiful about the Rebbetzins in Chabad, the Shluchiyot. Separated, isolated, well, let me quote the article. Isolated but not alone. It's how they keep in touch with each other and they support each other. Ach, you gotta give credit. If only the Messianics would keep quiet, it would be a lot better. The Art of Faith, this is a young kid interested in painting, and the Rebbe encourages him. He goes on to become a very famous painter, supports himself by selling his artwork. And again, it's the greatness of the Rebbe. This is very sad. My wife and I were shaking. Two female Israeli soldiers robbed and beaten while getting off the subway last week in Borough Park, Avenue Y on McDonald Avenue. That way of 20 plus years I spent every summer in Borough Park, Avenue Y was our stop. But these kids don't know America. They came, they bought iPads, and they walked around with Apple bags, and they come back to Brooklyn 11 o'clock at night. They're jumped upon by a boy and girl of a different color, and with knives beat the hell out of them. The boy had to be taken, the girl had to be taken to Maimonides Hospital, and rob the iPads and get their secret numbers, or threatened to kill them. God have mercy. These Israeli soldiers, that night they left, they came back to Israel on Thursday. So the worst part is, unless people in America will keep after the police, they'll get away with it. This is the ongoing battle. Should the state regulate yeshiva education? It's Miriam Mustard's, Mustard's wife, and fighting the battle, Bel's Chassidim, how they were raised with no knowledge whatsoever. She today is getting a PhD, must be very bright. The Jewish mobsters referenced in the Irishman retreat, and this goes back to the books that have been written, he didn't kill on Shabbos, how many Jewish gangsters there were, and this deals again with Mayor Arnold the Brain Rothstein, Nu Gedenkshim, the Chicago Fix, 1919, are you allowed to sit on that chair? His father gave a fortune of money to what is today Yeshiva University. Part of that chair may very well go back to that money that you're sitting on, that his son became Arnold Rothstein, gangster par excellence. Killed, murdered. Meyer Lansky, born Meyer Szczekowalanski in Poland. I am so angry at the state of Israel. They didn't let him remain here. Remember that? The 70s, Yosef Bork sent him back, and he was never indicted in America. The poor guy wanted to, it was a Shomer Shabbos already, wanted to die a Jew, had to go back to Florida.
Did you hear about the rabbi of El Al embezzling money
No, I didn't hear about that. That's something new. Do me a favor. I got enough with Dan Begria. Don't get me. This is now?
Yeah, last 2 weeks.
No, I didn't hear about it. Embezzling money?
From passengers, from people, from finances.
God almighty.
He and his son. His son was a gunner. He was in jail, but he joined
him. Unbelievable. Let it be. Rakefet, everyone rides. Rakefet walks, but at least he can talk freely. As far as I know, I've never taken a penny that's not mine. This is about a public broadcast that's now a Jewish thing. This guy, His grandfather learned in Slabatka, the other grandfather, Reconstructionist, the Asmicha, so-called, from Hebrew Union College, Ribbono Shel Olam. Upstate New York, the government is filing anti-Semitism. They won't allow the Jews to build there. The Hasidim want to come in and build the whole community. These fights go on time and time again. You need standards to make a sacrifice. This is a very interesting story of a musician. The Rebbe tells him he has to teach in Kfar Chabad. He teaches. Then they want him to teach women. And he doesn't want to teach women, and the Rebbe bends his hand to teach women. And finally, if I can believe this, this is the ultimate achievement about the Baron Cutler, and it's dealing with reparations money, something that you don't know about, but something I lived, Yitzchak lived it, the Rav lived it. Were we allowed to take reparations from Germany? The Rav totally opposed, Menachem Begin totally opposed, Rakefet is totally opposed until today. My wife says, you're wrong, that's the money that built Israel. And it was. They say the Rav, I don't know if he changed, he said, maybe I was wrong. I heard the Rav speak on a tape. But they claim you're taking money. The money belonged to Jews. The Hoekstra family had money. They never saw it again after the Holocaust. So at least let's say, all right. So now they had a meeting in New York. How much to ask for? So Rabbi Aaron Cutler got up and said, oh, yes, yeah, don't give the sums. A small sum. Tafasta meruba lo tafasta. And Rav Shmayo Guraye, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's brother-in-law, got up and said, no, I mean, call Hamada Hareza Meshubach. So Rabbi Aaron Cutler asked Rav Shmayo Guraye, does this ayah meaning? Is that your viewpoint? Or your brother-in-law, the Rebbe? And he said, nein, das ist der Rebbe, mir gesagt, the Rebbe told him, get as much as you can. So Rabbi Aaron said, if that's the case, let's give a high sum. That means Rabbi Aaron accepted the viewpoint of the seventh Rebbe. If that's true, terrific. And by the way, when they presented the sum to the German government answered, oh, that's all you want? Fine, you will get it. Okay. Finally, another freebie, but this is old, but it's very interesting. The Pinz Kalin Rebbe, who may be listening to our shiurim, he once said something in public that came right from this microphone. He's an American, he's very, very popular, very attractive, very charismatic, and mitasach seichel. This is 2018, the expanded Rosh Hashanah edition of Mishpacha. It is amazing, this beautiful magazine and how they put it out. And look what Jews love. All you get is the impression of food and clothes right up to date. This is Mishpacha. It's certainly not the way I grew up. It's certainly not the state of Israel I knew when I came in Aliyah 50 plus years ago. But time moves on. And perhaps the pshat is for Tolichenu. Koma miyut latzenu. Don't come here like schnurrers. Come here off the fat of the land. I want to thank
you.
You got it. You got it. Standing up. Standing up. I want to thank everyone for attending and being part of this wonderful classroom. Until we meet again in health and happiness. And Yitzchak, very sad that someone you knew so intimately, you don't recognize his picture. Neither did I. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. Ellie?
I'll take this from my wife and throw me into the house, though.
Ellie, it's okay. Ellie, can I see you for one second?
I wanted to ask you, I was trying to look at Rabbi Alexander Rosenberg.
I couldn't find anything.
I've been looking on the phone. I was trying to find, was he the guy who spoke at the March of the 400 rabbis?
Could be.
Yeah. I think, and he was from RCA then.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find him.
Could be, because he's a very, very prominent
when
rabbi.
You mentioned that.
Do me a favor now.
Sure.
I wanted Effie. Effie wasn't here yesterday. You weren't here. And I suffered because I spoke about this pamphlet and I gave ideas.
Are you talking about Sirius?
Yeah, so do tell Effie to tell his brother to listen to yesterday's shift.
Okay, well,
okay? I acknowledged the, and I gave an idea to take it further. Alright, this was very interesting. Why did you give it to me and stuff it's the muzzle way with paper on the back? Well, what? How'd you get, you had a whole different thing on the back, like you're too cheap to have a fresh piece of paper.
What, did I take notes on something?
No, it's a scribbling. I photographed it, so I'm giving it back to you. Now, this I spoke about yesterday.
I don't know.
What I marked. I raised an interesting issue.